Hello there, and welcome to Preprints in Motion, a podcast taking a deep dive in the fast-paced world of preprints.
Join us as we sit down with early career researchers, discuss their latest preprint, and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia.
Hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, and find us on Twitter at MotionPod. Support us by heading over to buymeacoffee.com/preprints. But for now, let's get into the show.
This month, the podcast is a whole 2 years old, and to celebrate, we're going to go back to discuss the history of preprint servers with Professor Matthew Cobb, who you may know from his own BBC podcast.
How are you?
I'm very well, and you?
I'm good. It's good to actually talk to you. You've been on my list of people I wanted to talk to for ages for this.
Okay.
So it's good. It's good to actually get you on. So I guess, just for people listening, because we've not recorded one of these for about 3 months, because I've been quite busy, I actually started a new job, and I've come in as the Associate Director at ASAP Bio now, which I've been doing for a month, which is really cool. But it does mean I have another conflict of interest that I guess I should save for this. Not that I think it's much of a conflict. I was already big on the preprints, so I don't think it makes much difference. So this is our 2 year birthday, and I thought what we'd do for this one is we'd take a look back at the history of preprint servers, because I firmly believe you can't go forward unless you know where you've been. I think it's really helpful to know where you've been and what has and hasn't worked to really take your steps forward. So this would be a good chance to do that. And I thought you would be a really good person to do that because you've written one of the papers that I see most often come up on a regular basis when people talk about the history of preprint servers. And you had a lot of really interesting quotes in there, mainly from journals, that I think we should touch upon. But I thought it would be really good to start with just giving a bit, sort of a background about you and your scientific journey.
I'm technically a professor of zoology at the University of Manchester. But I'm a bit of a fraud because I don't, my depth of zoological knowledge is fairly thin, let's put it that way. So by real occupation, I'm a Drosophila neurobiologist, and I have studied Drosophila behavior and genetics since the mid-70s. So that's a very long time, nearly half a century now. And I am now getting towards the end of my career, and I've, like most old people, I get very interested in history, and that's how I stumbled upon this material on the prehistory of preprints, which I wasn't looking for at all. I was doing some work in the Cold Spring Harbor Archives on the relationship, the collaborative relationship between Sidney Brenner and Francis Crick. And I came across some rather strange letters in the early 60s. And I then pulled upon a thread, the way you do, and discovered this, I think it's fair to say, certainly by biologists, completely forgotten part of the prehistory of preprints going back to the 1960s. And as a result of that, I ended up doing two things. I wrote an article that PLOS Biology very kindly published. And I also made a BBC radio program, or podcast, as I think young people now call them, called The Great Scientific Publishing Scandal, which looked partly at this, but also at the whole ecosystem of publishing, which we all know and love so much.
I've been doing it for a while now, and by a while I mean like a year and a half, but we're writing our own little documentary about the history of scientific publishing, and it is very, very interesting when you actually get into it. It sounds like one of those topics that should be really boring and not that much going on, but there's a surprising amount going on.
Well, there's a lot of heroes and villains in it, and
yeah,
what's very striking is that I mean, you said at the beginning that you needed to know history in order to be able to go forward. Well, it's very, very striking that people have repeatedly, not knowing their history, have done the same thing, and the same things have happened. Now, maybe we're in a different situation now, and we can discuss why that might be. But this is the current use of preprints by the life sciences, and increasingly since the pandemic by the medical sciences, is the third time that this has been tried. Yeah. And this time it seems that certain nefarious forces haven't squashed the experiment, but they have found a way to make vast sums of money despite the experiment.
As they do.
As they We're in the wrong do. Business. I think that's the conclusion I come to. Being scientific publishing.
I mean, I'm working against it now, so I'm really in the wrong business. We talked when we had Richard and John on. We did chat about sort of why BioArchive now was seeming to work when it had failed so many times in the past. So if anyone hasn't listened to that, go and listen to that. So I actually knew you before the sort of preprint stuff based on your Drosophila work, because my PhD was all in Drosophila immunology.
Okay.
So that's your name sort of vaguely came across me then. But how did you first get into preprints? Was it this IEG stuff or was it before?
Oh yeah, it was entirely through this. I mean, I knew about preprints and was kind of vaguely agnostic on them. I certainly wasn't hostile. I didn't think they were a bad thing. I knew that this was flourishing in physics as it had been since 1991, and that, you know, occasionally I'd go onto the archive and I'd look at things that were biologically oriented, or sometimes the more, you know, strange things, theoretical things published by physicists. And I had a rather mixed view, I think, of the content, because, you know, a lot of it was just kind of blog posts, really, and stuff I could understand. And so I thought, well, you know, I mean, I certainly didn't have any very strong feelings either way. It was entirely by bumping into these things called the information exchange groups that were set up by NIH in the early 1960s through this rather snotty letter from Francis Crick saying that when he was invited to join one, saying, no, thank you very much. Don't fancy that. And I thought, well, what are these? What are these things?
It is really surprising to see people like Crick early on in those. I just didn't think they would have been involved, because I did some tweets a while back when eLife changed their model to kind of put peer review into context a bit for people. And, you know, like the one of the things that came out of that is that the DNA Helix paper wasn't peer reviewed and that kind of stuff.
Well, peer review was very, very limited until the 80s, right? I mean, there's been a whole load of work done by historians of science on this. And I mean, basically what happened in the 1950s, so those three articles on the structure of DNA from the Cavendish by Watson and Crick, and from King's College London by Maurice Wilkins and by Rosalind Franklin. Those three articles were published together, back to back, under a common title. And I think those are all important things that people generally forget. What happened in those days was that the lab head submitted the article. So Crick and Watson gave their draft to Sir Lawrence Bragg, who was the head of the Cavendish. He wasn't their actual boss, but he was head of the lab within which they were working. And he then sent it to the editors of Nature with a nice covering letter saying, I think this is rather interesting. These are jolly good chaps. You might want to publish this, which they then did. And that was the way it was done. So there would be very minor editing. We know from, for example, that the Watson and Crick papers, the big paper they published on the real model of DNA, which only appeared in 1954, but was written in a couple of months after the double helix paper in Nature, that was published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And that did go out to peer review. And those the archives of the Royal Society have those reviews, but they are pretty tiddly, right? And it's basically, you've made a type of mistake on page three, right? So it's nothing like what we're used to today. And I can remember being asked to review papers that were sent to Nature in the late 70s on Drosophila behaviour by my PhD supervisor, who was too busy or didn't know the literature, I can't remember. He said, here, you have a look at this, tell me what you think. And, you know, you'd write a couple of paragraphs. It wasn't a, here's 2 years more research you've got to do for this to be up to our standards. Right? None of that nonsense. So, I mean, the current ecosystem is incredibly bizarre and very, very counterproductive, which has led to so much irritation and to so many repeated attempts to try and overcome what Leslie Vosshall in an article called The Glacial Pace of Scientific Publishing. And it's got a little bit more nimble, but not if you're trying to publish, say, in Nature or Cell, where you're still likely to get bogged down in several months, years of extra experimentation.
Yeah, I once, during my undergrad, there was a lecture we had where the guy presented his work, and it was a Nature paper. I mean, there was a lot of data in there, and this was still talking 10 years ago, but that took 10 years to get that paper out from when it was first ready to go, which is that just was insane to me that it could take that long.
I mean, that was my what's the point? You know, I mean, I know what the point is. You want to get a part, an article in Nature, because I think this is the, you know, we've already hinted at the big bads being the publishing companies, and they are. But, you know, we are complicit in this, and academia still can't get over its addiction to impact factors, to looking at the name of the journal in order to judge whether a paper and therefore a candidate, be it for recruitment or promotion, is actually worth what they claim. And it's this ludicrous short circuit. Now, you might think it's bad in science. I would encourage you and any listeners to go and talk to colleagues in the humanities and the social sciences, because there is actually a list of journals. This is a 4-star journal. So my wife is very, very happy. She's a social scientist. She has she got an article in a 4-star journal, which means that it's got a lot of big impact factor and has a good reputation. Now, her article is marvellous and has, as she tells me, been downloaded more than any other on her this particular website. She's very proud of that. And that's the thing, downloaded and cited, right? That's the real metrics. But the thing that satisfied her bosses was that she had got it in this top-ranked journal. Yeah. And that's exactly the same as saying I've got it in Science, Cell and Nature. The difference being that we have this informal way of dealing with it. But as I say, in the humanities and social sciences, this is actually written into the structure of the discipline. And I mean, it's mind-boggling. So our university, University of Manchester, was one of the first to sign up to the Declaration on Research Assessment, or DORA, or the San Francisco Declaration. And that is that you should not use journal titles as a proxy for quality of either an article and even less of a particular candidate. And yet I have sat in as an external advisor on promotion panels in our Faculty of Humanities, and because they have this ludicrous system of classification of journals, all that was going on was people saying, well, you know, she's only got 2 4-star papers, so that's not good enough. She can't be promoted to chair or whatever. And when I raised that this was in profound contradiction to one of the things that the university had signed up to, I was met with complete bemusement by my colleagues. So I shut up, you know.
Yeah, I mean, anyone on Twitter currently will be well aware of the debate going on around that recent eLife article. And again, there's so many people going, oh, I really want the system to change, but I'm not going to do it. And it makes me really angry.
Well, I think that particular incident, I mean, there are issues to do with, I mean, the savagery of the reviews was pretty devastating, which would suggest that there were problems. I mean, in fact, the three reviewers all said the same thing. This is all about the homeowner lady claims for burial and maybe even marks that are made in this cave in South Africa. I think what you've got are two things there. One, there is a problem with the mismatch between the claims in the article and the reviews. But then there is also all the media brouhaha, which has been part of the funding of this research program. People forget that. They just think that researchers are, you know, publicity hungry, which they may well be, but they're really hungry for funding. And that's how they got the funding, by doing the projects first in the past with National Geographic and now with Netflix. So, you know, if you can't get big grants from NIH, how are you supposed to get your money to go potholing in tiny, claustrophobic, deep caves in South Africa? And as people have said, forget about the brouhaha. The fossils are absolutely amazing. The question is all about the interpretation of them. And that is something, of course, that peer review can kind of guide and structure an article sometimes. And indeed, my article on these information exchange groups from the 1960s benefited from that. I mean, I did publish it as a preprint on PeerJ, PJ preprints, which existed back then. This was in 2016-17. But the peer review made it a lot better. Now, I appreciate that peer review on BioArchive or wherever can improve things. Or more often what you see on Twitter is people saying, hey, you know, we published our article on BioArchive and a load of people emailed us and they either pointed out that we were stupid or even better, they said, hey, I've got some data that can help with this and we're now doing this, that and the other. And the end article is qualitatively better. The question is, have the data changed?
And which I've done work on, and it
generally doesn't, you know, because the data are the data. What happens is you get extra, as a consequence of peer review, you get extra experiments. Maybe you'll nuance your conclusions, or amazingly, you will cite a certain person who insists that you must cite the work. I wonder who that could be. That having been said, if you are a peer reviewer, I'm afraid I often deliberately insist that people cite other people's work. But if it's somebody I know whose work I'm reviewing and I'm being not terribly helpful, because I don't think it's a very good article, I will put in lots of deceptive ways of trying to put them off the tracks by insisting that they cite Smith and Jones and using American spelling. That's another good one. And I did, in fact,
that's mean.
I had the horror of having to review my PhD supervisors, one of my PhD supervisors' paper. So I did all that, and then got a. He's died now. His name is Barry Burnett. He's a lovely man. Then I got a letter from him a few months later saying, "Those bastards, that referee, he said that blah 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 blah," and I know who it is. And I thought, I'm afraid, Barry, you don't. It was me.
I mean, I will keep that one in the back pocket if I ever need it. That's a really good thing to do. So we should probably talk about these IEGs and sort of what they are, where they came from. So could you give us, I mean, what are the IEGs?
Well, they were things called the Information Exchange Groups. They were set up in 1961 by the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, and they were an attempt to increase the pace of scientific communication, right? And you have to remember that in a world that was not digital, that everything was done analog and physically, the only way of finding out what people were doing or getting your article published, I mean, this used to be the case, even the beginning of this century, you actually would physically send off a typed manuscript to a journal in an envelope. You would then eventually hear back from the journal with typed reviews, which you would respond to. And then you would send it back again, and then they would have to send it to editing, and then it would get sent to a typesetter who would actually have to move little bits of lead about, little bits of metal on a page to turn it into something looking nice. You would then get the proofs and they would then have to send them back. So all that would take years, literally. I mean, it was an incredibly slow process. And what the NIH wanted to do, and this was the idea of two men, a man called Eret Olbritton, who was an administrator, and in particular of David Green, who was a biochemist. And they kind of dreamt up this idea of having a central repository for manuscripts. And it very quickly, because people were already sending, you know, when you published, when you've written an article, you'd send it off to journal of whatever. But you'd also send it to your mates. I mean, unless you were crazy, right? And or you didn't have any mates. Or you're doing something so niche that nobody cared about, which would have been me. So you'd send it to your mates to say, what do you think? And they would maybe look at it or they'd hand it round or whatever. So there was, you know, preprints. I mean, if you use Google Ngram, I did this the other day, to see where, you know, preprints as a term, how does it distributed over time? And it was around in the 40s and 50s. People were describing manuscripts that had not been published as preprints. And sometimes they were the final version that had been accepted by the journal, generally, as we've already indicated, with very little tinkering about. But often they were more speculative think pieces. So what Olbritton and Green wanted to do was to enable more people to get access to these things. And basically what you would do is you would send in a manuscript to the NIH. They would then duplicate it, right? We don't have photocopying yet. So this is being duplicated. It's being typed up onto stencils. young people will have no idea what I'm talking about, right? Go on Google, right? This is, oh, these are old reproductive technologies, but basically involves a machine, a drum churning round and copies of paper coming off, and then you've got to turn it over and put it back in, duplicate the other side, then you've got to staple them all together, you've got to put them in envelopes, and then you've got to send them out, right? So these were, initially, this was all focused on a topic, right? So Green was interested in oxidative phosphorylation. So the first information exchange group, or IEG, was set up with 32 people who would agree to circulate drafts, comments, reviews. So they send, you send it into the NIH and they then send it out. And that worked very well from 61 to 63. And then by 1963, and this is when I bumped into it, Old Britain decides that he wants to extend this, and he starts soliciting big names, right? So that's Crick, Bredder, Mono, and others, trying to see, well, would you be interested, right? So trying to expand it. This did lead to a number of new IEGs. So there was one on hemostasis, computer simulation of biological systems, molecular basis of muscle contraction, immunopathology, and interferon. And then finally, in 1966, one was set up on nucleic acids and the genetic code, which was set up by Watson and Nirenberg. Now, I said we had 32 scientists with the first one in 1961. With that one on nucleic acids, which is clearly the sexiest topic you could imagine, and the genetic code, in 66, then over 1,100 people immediately signed up. So you would now have to send out over 1,000 copies of each of these damn, you know, drafts, essays, or whatever. So there, it turned into an absolute behemoth. I've got some figures here. They sent out absolutely thousands of these things. So you've got to remember that that's, we're talking about millions of pages of paper were being duplicated and shoved in envelopes and sent round the post. So it was a huge effort. It wasn't only, I think the key thing to remember is this was not only limited to the US. It was funded by the NIH, which caused an issue. But over a third of IEG members were from outside the US. They were mainly from the UK, Japan and Australia. But they also enabled people behind the Iron Curtain to get access to this material as well. And you've got to remember, the only way of getting an article, there are two ways of reading a scientific article. You either had a library that subscribed to the journal, or you wrote to the author when you heard about it. You wrote a little card. We all had these little cards saying, "Dear," and then there was a blank, and you'd read Dr. X. Please send me a reprint. You know, so you, when you got your article published, you would also get a certain number of reprints, actual copies of physical copies that were printed separately, and you would have to pay for. And you'd normally get 100 of these things or something like that. And you could then send them round to your mates. And it was a rather brutal indication of how interesting your article was, how quickly you got through these things. And I've been clearing out my office recently, and I can tell you, I had quite a few leftover reprints. But
boxes full, just stuck in a corner.
Well, I mean, it didn't really always work that way. I mean, you know, Crick was still giving out reprints of the 53 Nature article in the late 50s, and he only had a couple of hundred. So, yeah, we all sent round these little postcards to each other. I think the most interesting one I got was one from somebody in East Germany, and it was in Latin. So the language of scholarship still lived, and this was in the early 80s. So the IEGs were set up to try and short-circuit this, and also, you know, not only the commercial constraints of not having access to a journal because your library didn't subscribe to it, but also the very slow process of publication and the growing grumpiness of reviewers, which was starting at around this point. I said earlier on there wasn't a great deal of review, but there was enough to irritate people. And it was explicitly designed to overcome this. So this is all doing very well, except it's turning into, it's beginning to get out of their control. So the NIH budget was, you know, not illimited, and it's estimated this cost was about $3 million a year. So it's not overwhelming, but it was still a pretty hefty chunk of the NIH budget. And of course, this success then had two consequences. One, it was increasingly expensive and cumbersome. But secondly, the publishers started to get a bit cross, which is where we start to ring bells, because the the publishing industry had been really transformed by one of the most wicked men in the 20th century, who's Robert Maxwell, who not only stole all the money from the Daily Mirror pension fund and therefore deprived lots of journalists and print workers of their pension and destroyed his company. And if you watch the fantastic film Tetris, you can see he also had his finger in that pie. He was an astonishing bad man. And the main thing he did was to create something called Pergamon Press, which was a commercial printing arm. And what he realized was, and this is shortly after the Second World War, that academics are quite vain. And if you say to them, "Dear Dr. X, would you like to set up a new journal, the Journal of Wiggly Things that nobody cares about? And we would like you to be on the editorial board and to run this, and, you know, we'll organize it. You need, of course, to ensure that your library subscribes to the Journal of Wiggly Things that nobody cares about, and to encourage as many of your colleagues to get their libraries to subscribe to it." So what Maxwell realized was that there was a kind of terrible feedback loop here, that you could, as science was expanding with more and more money being poured into it, and universities expanding and all the rest of it, that you could, in fact, create new journals that would make him a great deal of money and would cost money to the university libraries and ultimately to the institutions and funders that kept the university libraries going. So you've got this clash now of, one, this kind of 60s, hey man, let it all hang out, IEGs. I mean, they were created a lot long before that would have been fashionable. And on the other hand, Robert Maxwell's money grubbing, let's make as much money as we can approach. And they realised, Pergamon and Maxwell and the learned societies that were already in hock to the publishers, because we now know this is the terrible kind of deal that we've all made, that our learned societies, which we like so much and which organise conferences and help young people with grants, are only have that money, not because we pay lots of money in subscriptions, but because they've sold the rights to their journal to a publisher who then gives them a cut, which they can then put back into the community. And that's how we justify this terrible, terrible deal that we've got ourselves hooked on. And that was the case back in the 60s too. And the journals hooking into concerns from the kind of grumpier and crustier members of the academic community that this might lead to a lowering of standards, because, well, there's no peer review, and, you know, what about the quality of the journal, and anybody could publish anything this way, and how could we actually keep control of all this? They didn't all speak like that, but I think they started a push back in the mid 60s and started to argue that this should stop, because it would, well, the justification was, this will lead to a flood of crap, basically. There's no quality control anymore, either by the editors or by the reviewers, and therefore, you know, we won't know what's true anymore. Mm. But the real underlying issue was the financial threat. And this got particularly strong when, in an inversion of what people generally think of the story of preprints, it was physics that followed biology. So we generally think of, oh, well, there's been the archive, and then, you know, finally biology caught up. Yeah, the actual reality is that there were these IEGs set up at the beginning of the 60s with this huge success. And then the physicists got really interested in that and decided to set up something called the Physics Information Exchange. This was proposed in Physics Today and so on. And although it wasn't exactly like the IEGs, partly because there wasn't a single funder who was going to pay for it, it was basically based on the IEGs. And this was explicitly said. They said they referred to the success that the IEGs had encountered amongst biologists, that we can expect the same things. And that really set the cat amongst the pigeons in the mid-60s, 1966, because this meant that, I mean, there was even more money to be at. Physics was much bigger, of course, than the life sciences in those days. And there was even more money under threat. So basically, to cut a very long story short, both the academic publishers and the journals, in particular Nature, which played a really, really bad role in this. They were, a couple of years ago, they were crowing about in Nature about how important preprints were. Mm-hmm. And I sent them a rather snotty letter saying, yeah, you might say that now, but you didn't back in the 60s. Yeah. And they had the decency to publish it. But Nature were really bad, and they talked about, they said this, the proposal for the physics information exchange was offensive. They hoped it would be stillborn. And they said, next to downright villainy, misguided zeal is one of the most dangerous forces in society. I mean, really, really kind of dreadful. They said that NIH was suspect in what it was doing with this. You know, it was a commercial it was a state organization that was threatening its commercial interests. And an astonishing cheek, they said, you'd be much better off using that money and giving it to us, a commercial publisher. Let's not forget, Nature has always been a commercial publisher, right? Its sole function is to make money. They say, give us the money to improve our processes. Well, do it yourself, mate. So they were really, 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 really bad about it. And the issue was not only that there was the potential for this to bypass the normal publishing route, but that everybody accepted in the scientific community that an article published through an IEG had priority. So the big worry people are worried about with bioarchive and all the rest of it is, oh, well, somebody's going to steal my idea. They'll see it. And you know, and that was the same back in the day. So the agreement was, if it's published in an IEG, then you have priority. And of course, the journals couldn't accept that because they were the gatekeepers, and science waded in as well. And eventually there was a meeting in Vienna, Journal of Chemical Biology, Journal of Molecular Biology, which was a commercial journal from the outset, set up by Academic Press. 13 journal editors met and they said, right, that's it. We will not accept any articles that have appeared as a preprint. So basically they killed it. And the community wasn't sufficiently well organized to be able to fight back to it. And basically they rolled over. I think part of the issue was that the NIH was under financial strain anyway. And this thing was just getting absurd now. I mean, they were turning into a publisher, right?
Yeah.
Literally. I mean, it wasn't like this is simply a repository. So the great advantage of digital material system is that you just stick it on a server and then people do what they want with it. And you've just got to pay for the humming of the server and that's it, which is not negligible, I know, but it's still compared to printing, stapling, collating, shoving in an envelope to thousands of people. I mean, that is publishing, right?
I mean, I'd understand all the money we pay to publishers if we were still doing that, because at least you can see where your money would be going.
Yeah, but you really don't understand, Johnny, the amount of effort that we put into our X communications or X reports journal. I mean, it's immense, absolutely immense. I mean, so that's the issue. I mean, we had this in the, you've got to remember that the system back then was entirely, you gave the article to the publisher. The publisher then held the copyright to that, but you didn't pay anything. The people who paid were the people who wanted to read the article. And because science was much less well communicated, because the whole communication system of the world wasn't as it is now, was less connected, then you simply had to go to a library if you wanted to read an article, or you would write to the, you know, if you weren't an academic, you would have to find out, you know, go to your local library, or very unlikely your local library would have the Journal of Molecular Biology. It might well have a copy of Nature. And you'd have to go to a big library to go to read the more obscure journals. And that would be the only way that you, if you weren't an academic, would have of getting hold of this information.
I mean, I still just about remember the world before the internet, just
yeah,
and actually going places, and it was very different.
Yeah, and it was also to be really old and grumpy, is that what you missed, what you don't get today is serendipity, right? You don't bump across things. You're looking for one thing in the library, and you turn a page, or you look at the book next door, or the volume next door, and that's really interesting. But anyway, we've got Twitter to discover things.
Well, for now.
For now. So the only way that the money was being made at the time by the publishers was by selling subscriptions, right? That's the only route that they had. Now, what's happened in the last few years is the publishers have been, we can fast forward a bit, and in 1991, the archives set up for physicists, and this is just a server, because the physics information exchanges went the same way. They folded. None of this actually worked because the publishers killed it dead. As the editor of Science put it, this was government subsidized shoddy merchandise, and that it should stop. Right. So they just basically killed it in order to carry on making their money and to maintain their positions. Yeah. And I think that everybody these days, even maybe those editors would agree that this was utterly, or those journals rather, the editors are all dead, would agree this was utterly indefensible and was the wrong thing to do.
Well, I mean, they've been buying all the preprint servers up, so they've seen where the money is.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but they tried. I mean, you've got to remember that with physics, with that working in 1991, at the end of the 90s, there were attempts to try and doing this again. In particular, with Harold Varmus, who was head of NIH, and he wanted to set up exactly this kind of thing, because he noticed that it was working, and so he decided, okay, we're in a digital age now. This is 1999, and he says, right, we're going to set up an equivalent of the archive, which is called eBiomed. And that would be basically what BioArchive is now. And the journals, again, really kicked back. The New England Journal of Medicine was particularly foul about it, which has had this rule since the IEGs that anything that is even published on a blog or a website, any publication of any sort, which would or reference to an article, in work in progress, would prohibit it from being published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So if your sole route to promotion is having an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, then effectively you couldn't participate in any alternative alternative publishing scheme, because you wouldn't get an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. So we're back to us scientists actually being completely hypocritical about this, railing on the one hand about the iniquities of this system, but then being completely complicit in it, in our systems of promotion and recruitment. And indeed by our learned societies selling our journals to the publishers. So I don't think, nobody comes out of this well, right? And
no.
I think a lot of people who get very cross about it don't look at themselves and their own practice and the practice, certainly the practice of their institutions, with a sufficiently hard eye. So Varmus tried to set this up. This failed. The journal stopped it again. And that's what led, on the one hand, to the foundation of PLOS, and also we got Biomed. That's that's the best thing that we've got out of that. You get the final copy of the article is available, but you can't actually get the PDF or the final printed version. That's the backstory to that particular bit of our current ecosystem. So after the failure of Varmus's initiative, there was something called ClinMed NetPrints, which died a death in 2005. Nature Preceedings, do you see what they did there?
Yeah.
Which ran from 2007-2012. And then in 2013, there were the first two biology preprint service, that is PeerJ Preprints, which was a commercial enterprise, and BioArchive, which was set up by Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, which is the surviving version. And there have been lots of now kind of different versions. There's the MedArchive and PaleoArchive and all sorts of other little archives. So it finally worked. But I think there are two reasons for that. Firstly is the journals realized they could make money. They could make money in two ways. One, by selling open access, because part of the drive behind this is, well, why should we have these journals behind paywalls? Why should information that I, as a taxpayer, have paid for, why should I not be able to read it? And this has been particularly driven in the medical area, where, you know, we've all read these articles by, you know, medics who are trying to save their children's lives and can't get hold of the article that they have actually published. And they want to find out exactly what dose or whatever of, you know, some cancer saving drug. And they've been unable to because of these absurd paywalls. So the journalists, there was pressure in particular from the EU to enable all publicly funded research to be open access. Bit of the same thing in the US. And encouraged by something, things like the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, which also said that anybody who gets funding from us must publish their material open access. So this all started to lead the journal article, the journal publishers to think, well, how can we make money in this case if we're giving it away? Ah, we'll flip it. We'll now make people pay to publish, which, as I said, was not what happened, with very few exceptions. One of the exceptions was the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which, in the, if you go back and look in the old days, it used to have a little star at the bottom of every paper saying this article has been paid for and must therefore must technically be described as an advertisement, which was used to shock me when I was a naive. I think, so what do you mean you're paying to publish? I mean, doesn't that mean it's a load of crap? Well, it was P&S, I suppose. You see, I've just done it again. I have just labelled a whole bazillions of papers by the name of the journal.
That one kind of works, though.
So the journals realised they could make money out of it by making us pay for access. And so all that's happened is things have got, in a way, they're great. You can get hold of this stuff now. But it's got even worse in that the journals are making even more money. We are funding these journals in order to enable them to make more money, where it's just going round. The money's coming in from the taxpayer into universities and research organisations that are going straight back out into the gaping maw of the shareholders of these handful of major companies, a tiny amount of which then trickles down into the learned societies, and they feel better about themselves by funding PhD students to go to conferences and so on.
But of course, that we're still paying for the library subscriptions as well, so we're still double paying.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're paying for it twice over. And of course, I mean, in my BBC podcast, I interviewed the librarian at the University of Manchester and asked him how much we pay, and he said, I can't tell you.
Yeah.
Because it's all non-disclosure agreements, you know. So the libraries don't actually, each library in a different country doesn't, each country doesn't know what the library in the university next door is paying. And they're not allowed to talk about this because this would be a cartel. Whereas, of course, the publishing industry is in nothing like that.
Not at all. Not even slightly. Everywhere you look at it, it's shady business practices.
Well, they're protecting their interests, and finally they worked out a way of making money by acceding to the desire to have preprints on the one hand, so material to get rapid access to results, which is the main thing you get with the preprint. You know, when I read preprints in my area, it's the results I'm interested in. And yes, there are shady results, but there's shady results everywhere, and we know this. And, you know, people are doing bad things because of the pressure on recruitment and promotion again to cut corners and tell fibs. And you know what, that's not just since the age of Photoshop. It goes back way back to the 30s and before that. So that's always happened, that you've had extraordinary claims that have not been backed up by extraordinary evidence. And one of the good things about science is that generally comes out in the wash. And if it, you know, I mean, I do get cross, of course, about people faking their results, but often you think, was that really worth it? Because nobody cares. Studying is just so irrelevant. And, you know, it will be cited. You got to remember that the average, I think the modal citation frequency excluding self-citations of an article is less than one.
Yeah, it's, people just don't care. But everyone who does the research thinks it's the best thing in the world.
Yeah, I mean, so the problem is you have to keep that. The problem is it's a razor's edge, right? Mm. So you have to say to young people, look, don't get too hung up on it. But of course, if you don't get hung up enough, you won't do the work.
Yeah.
And it's actually interesting and fun and better than working on a production line or whatever. So, you know, let's not knock it. It's fantastic and an amazing privilege to be able to find stuff out. Just that most stuff you find out is just interesting to you and your two or three mate stroke competitors.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've covered the history there. We touched upon the fact that the pandemic had a huge impact on...
Yeah, well, preprints. We didn't actually mention that. I think the pandemic was actually really significant in pushing it. And in particular, amongst the medics, who were quite rightly... Because clearly, you know, me studying something about Drosophila behaviour, right, it doesn't matter a damn if it's not right. I mean, if you know, even if I fake the results, which I never did, but, you know, even though I had done, then so what? It's just going to mean somebody's going to be wasting their time a bit if they try to replicate my findings. On the other hand, if I say, you know, ivermectin will cure COVID, then there's a bit of an issue, right? Because it's a load of crap and it's not true. So from the very outset, and this is an argument that went back to the 60s in the IEGs, people were saying, look, if it's a clinical issue, you shouldn't be doing this, because people can then, you know, if it hasn't been, at least the advantage of peer review is at least you say, well, does it make sense, right? Yeah. Ivermectin, horse parasites, is it likely? You know, so you then look at it quite critically. But on the other hand, now we live in a world where, well, yeah, you can put this on a server and a journalist picks it up, because that's what journalism is these days, trawling the web and looking at Twitter. And hey, presto, then, you know, it's all over the news sites that ordinary people are reading, not just simply amongst the cognoscenti, who might or might not be expected to have a more critical view, a more informed view anyway. So I think it was legitimate and still is that people should be very wary of clinical claims in preprints. But the pandemic was of such global significance that it was essential that we had that information. We could not, you know, if you imagine that we were still in the kind of 6 months to 8 months slow, even for a fast publication, right? And for an ordinary publication, maybe 2 years. We would have been in a right old mess.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, MedArchive now do add extra steps in the screening process for clinically relevant preprints. They even say they won't necessarily share everything just out of the fact that some things do need that peer review.
Yeah, aspect. And I think that's absolutely right. Mm. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
I gave a talk, 2 months ago now at a surgeon-based conference, which was scary, all about preprints. And they were generally receptive, which was quite nice. I was expecting more hostility. But yeah, medics are still the group that hold out the most and are most against preprints. And I do understand it. It is, like you said, it's a much more important topic because it actually affects people.
Yeah.
So is there anything that... Well, actually, where do you think the future is going to go? Do you think we're all going to switch over to preprints eventually? Because preprints, you know, even after the pandemic... So before the pandemic, I think it was about 3-point-something% of the literature was preprinted in the life sciences. It's now about 10% after the pandemic, but it's kind of flatlined a bit, so it looks like we're a bit stuck again. So, I mean, what does the future hold, do you think?
I don't know. If I knew that, I'd be rich. Come on. I have enough trouble knowing about the past and the present without knowing about the future.
Where would you like the future to go?
Well, as I say, I'm not, you know, utterly evangelical about preprints, you know. I think there's two aspects to it. One is to get your information out there quickly if it's really exciting. And so as a consumer, as a reader of papers, then it's really great to be able to, you know that there's this, even if it hasn't been reviewed. So if I'm teaching this stuff to final year students, I'll say, look, well, this is a preprint. But you know what? If it's, I don't know, the structure of a protein, it's not going to change, right? That will not change. I believe the, you know, in the same way as I believe and accept the results if they're published and have been through the terrible grind of the publication process, I accept and believe the results. And so, you know, I trust my colleagues. They're not going to, in general, the vast majority of cases, 99.999, however many nines you want, percent of cases. They are not going to lie. So the data are the data, right? And I sometimes then have to think harder about what they mean. But that's fantastic. And I like that I can get that really, really quickly. I also explain to the students that it hasn't been peer reviewed and explain what that does and doesn't mean. It doesn't mean, you know, clearly if it's been peer reviewed, that is absolutely true. But it does mean that certain arguments have been gone through. And now, increasingly, not only with eLife, but other journals are now publishing the reviews, which is, if you have the time,
yeah,
really interesting to read and to reflect upon a particular process. But I guess that, you know, in the same way as if we were all able to read all the reviews that were ever written, most of them would be not very interesting because the articles aren't devastatingly significant or whatever. So I think that really what I'm interested in, to be honest, less than preprints, is this fixation on the journal that we're all guilty of, right? And I'm as guilty as anybody else, right? And partly that is because that there is an element of truth to it. That is, there is a rigor and a perceived sexiness of an article, whatever that might be. And you can, I'm not saying it's objective, but, you know, we have a particular view about what is interesting now. And that the rigor that is associated, or the difficulty, let's just use that word, the difficulty of publishing in those journals that have very restricted number of articles published, which is now completely artificial, you know, clearly, because they could publish as many as they want. And indeed they do for their second tier journals that really produce the money. They could publish more, but they don't. And that's part of their brand, right? We will only publish a certain restricted range of stuff, which also means that you only understand the titles of about, I don't know, 10% of the articles in, you know, Science or Nature. I mean, you know, never mind about the abstracts, because it's just not, you know, not your field.
It helps that a lot of them have single cell sequencing in the title. Makes it a bit easier.
So I think that that's the issue, is that we've got to get away from this. And it is really hard then, because if we say, you know, the argument is, oh, well, you've got to read the article. Well, if you read the article, it takes a hell of a long time, right? So I think for promotion and recruitment panels, which is partly the source of all this, that's where it gets amplified and transmitted literally from generation to generation. I think maybe the way is, okay, send in your CV and send us your best article, which we will read. And then the panel, and in the case of, I mean, God knows how in REF, the research exercise framework in the UK, how the panels were able to read those articles. Yeah. I think people worked out they had about 4 minutes to read an article. And they were, of course, not going to use the journal title as any kind of proxy. I'm sure that never happened. But, you know, unless it's all blind, it's going to happen, right? Yeah. You know, so that is the issue. That is the problem. And it's been the journals and us turn this into and this is Eugene Garfield of the Institute of Scientific Information, who's responsible for this, for coming up with the impact factor. I don't know if you saw on Twitter yesterday or today, it was satirical. What is it called? IF Shade, and so they're saying, right,
yes,
what we're going to do is the impact factor will basically be classed into four colors or five colors, and these will be printed on the PDF. So if it's a top ranking journal, it will be green. So you don't actually even need to look at anything. You can just go by the color. It's either green, yellow, orange, or amber, or we will print it in the same, the background color will be the same color as the print.
I can see that. Bother about it. I can see that really taking off.
And of course, there were people who took it seriously. I thought it was very funny. But that is the issue. That is exactly what my colleagues in the humanities do.
Yeah.
You know, they have this star system of journals, and it is outrageous. And DORA, which, as I said at the beginning, you know, our many universities have signed up to, including mine, and then completely ignore.
Yeah.
And I think that is the heart of the matter. There's a lot of other stuff in there, but that's why we can't break the habit, because we are absolutely hooked on impact factors. No matter how much we say we're not, we're still, whether it's the the number, whether it's the name of the journal or whether it's the colour of the paper that the PDF comes on, or the, not the paper, but the, you know, whatever, on the screen, that is the problem. Mm. That is what underlies it. And we don't, you know, we're, there's too much stuff to read. I'd also say people were saying this back in the 60s, they're complaining about the amount of stuff they had to read. Yeah. Bloody hell, you've no idea. And this actually drove attempts to try and mechanize data extraction and all the rest of it. So there's a whole history to information processing and, you know, librarian studies from the 50s, 60s and 70s. There's a prehistory to this, which some you know, historians of information processing have looked at. But it's really interesting about, again, the same problems come up over and over again. There's a tide of stuff. We can't work out what's important. We've got to find new tools for trying to extract that information. We still haven't succeeded in overcoming that problem. Yeah. It's just getting worse and worse. And you preprint people are just making it even worse because we get even more stuff.
Yep. And quicker.
And quicker. Comes in my bloody inbox. So, I mean, I don't know what the answer is. I'm not, what do you think? Should it be 100% articles pre-printed? Why?
I think, yes. I think the thing is, as you said, we do need that. You need a way of wading through everything, because certainly if it's not your field, you just haven't got the time to figure out if it's good or not. And we do need a way of not having hiring committees or grant bodies reading like hundreds of papers.
Yeah.
Well, thousands of papers. So we need something in place that get around that. But then I also don't think we should stick to the traditional journal article. I think that's outdated. So I think we should move away from that. But then that creates even more data bits because you're breaking it down, right?
Yeah.
And I think what would be nice to eventually end up in, and I don't really know how this would work, but it would be a situation where it's more work in progress. So Lab X is working on this thing and they update as they get data through, more like a lab notebook is. And maybe a slightly finished version, polished version of that. But
well, again, I think maybe you know, the life sciences need to look at the humanities and the social sciences because they have a long tradition of having called, what are they called? Not works in progress or paper, I forgot what they call them. But they will, effectively, it's a preprint. They circulate a version of their chapter, manuscript, monograph or whatever. They send it around to all their mates. Or that's how they used to do it. I mean, maybe they put it on a server now. And then they update it as they think more about it. They discover new sources or people send them angry emails saying, you haven't cited me. And I guess that's part of the same thing. On the other hand, for Christ's sake, when you finished an article, I mean, you know, when you finish the experiment, you just want to move on and do something else. The idea that I've got to go back and keep on updating it because you buggers keep on making criticisms. Well, do your own work, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is an issue, you know, there's an issue about it then. I mean, part of the problem with writing an article, and I'm not quite so sanguine as you, that the article will disappear. I mean, it's been around for...
I don't think it's going to disappear.
350 years, right? Is that... you get to a point where it's not getting any better. It's just getting different and you keep on changing it and they've got to take it away from you, right? This is the same with all writing, not just scientific articles, but at least you know you've done the experiments. You've got all the evidence that you could possibly imagine until reviewer two gets their hands on it to find, you know, to support your argument. Mm. But then you've got an issue about peer review. Now, I'm not against peer review. I don't find it...
I would like to see less. I think most work doesn't need to be peer-reviewed. I think it would be better if we switch to focusing on, like you said, for the medical stuff. So if we focus peer-review where it's needed and do a better job there, I think that would be better than the system we currently have.
Well, we can argue. I mean, that's the same. I would argue as well with the grant funding system, which is a different issue. I think that should be literally a lottery.
I do as well.
Triage for the loons, people who've got, you know, who found life on Mars or who have perpetual motion machines, they should be zapped out. And then the other 90% of applications, there should be a simple lottery. I think Switzerland's trying this at the moment. And
Australia,
we would save a vast amount of time. Because anybody who's been on a grant panel knows that you can't, with any confidence, say that the paper, the grant that was just above the cutoff was qualitatively better than the grant just below, because it, or even the one at the top of the rank, because you know what, unless it's absolutely boring and they know what they're going to find, which is of course was what you have to say. Anyway, that's a different issue.
Yeah, no, I agree. Lotteries, I would like to see more of as well. But that was great. Thank you for that.
Okay, no problem.
You're welcome. Learned stuff, and I thought I knew it.
And that's the show, folks. If you enjoyed listening, then hit that subscribe button to get the latest updates straight to wherever it is you're listening. Don't forget to rate us on Spotify or Apple and follow us on Twitter at MotionPod. You can find links to things we've just discussed on our website, preprintsinmotion.com. If you'd like to tell us what you think, then send an email, shout at us on Twitter, or shout at us if you see us walking down the street. This has been a JMJ production, generously supported by our friends at ASAP Bio. Until next time, have a good week.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer to everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows.